MacCast, Wednesday, May 2nd, 2018. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, you're getting a little bit of smoky Adam today, I think. I went to Las Vegas over the last weekend for the morning stream meetup. That's Scott Johnson's show from the Frog Pants Network. If you don't listen to that podcast, you should definitely check it out. It's a lot of fun. Actually, Scott Johnson and Brian Ibbett from Coverville. And it was a lot of fun. I had a great time, but I have to tell you, being from California, where we never encounter smoke, it's a big change. I was almost immediately the first day feeling it in my lungs, and you may hear that coming out a little bit in this podcast. I don't know. It sounds kind of good. Maybe sultry a little bit. Maybe you like it. Let me know what you think about it. But anyway, we're going to get right into the Apple news today and a bunch of your feedback and comments and stuff like that. We have a number of things to talk about, including Apple's second quarter earnings. They had their results call yesterday, so I've got all the numbers and details on that for you. We're going to talk about what's happening with macOS and iOS and a little project to maybe merge some things and what that means potentially for you. Also, little updates on iPhones. We're going to talk about possible Mac updates coming or not coming, a little Apple VR stuff, AirPort and some major news that happened around that, although some of you might have seen that coming, and a little bit of a replacement program for some batteries for some of you. We'll get into that, and then we have your feedback, lots of feedback on the Mac Pro stuff we've been talking about recently. I was a little bit upset about Apple delaying the updated Mac Pro, and I thought that was a big deal, but you're telling me maybe it's not such a big deal. We're going to talk again a little bit more about AirPorts. I've got a few quick questions, comment on some stuff that I've been dealing with my Mac and how I resolve that, and something that might help you out too. And then some Apple Music questions and HomePod stuff will round out the show. So it should be a good episode. I think we're just going to dive right in, starting with Apple's second quarterly results call. They came out with their numbers and they were very good, especially when it comes to revenue. Apple made quite a bit of money. In fact, they had their best March quarter ever with revenue of $61.1 billion. That was up, and that was billion with a B. That was up from 16% from the same quarter a year ago. As far as what they sold 52.2 million iPhones, 9.1 million iPads, and 4.1 million Macs. That means that iPhone unit sales were actually up just slightly, about 1.4 million units over the same period last year. And that's despite the rumors that we had been hearing in the supply chain that iPhone X was not selling well. As a matter of fact, Tim Cook addressed that directly. He said that customers chose iPhone X more than any other iPhone each week in the March quarter, just as they did following the launch in December. So in the December quarter, he had commented on the same thing, that the iPhone was the top-selling phone among all of Apple's markets. And he was very keen to point out that was also in all markets, and that the iPhone had done very well. The iPhone X specifically had done very well in China. So, you know, don't believe everything you hear from the supply chain. As Tim Cook often says, you can't use one data point or one source of component parts to kind of figure out how sales are going. And the revenue certainly seems to indicate that iPhone X sales are doing just fine. I guess a lot of the question is, are they doing as well as Apple had expected, or are they hoping for more? But, you know, all we have to go on is what Apple comments on in these results calls, and they seemed very positive about iPhone X. iPad sales were also up just slightly year over year by about 0.2 million units, and Mac sales were down just a hair, just a tiny, tiny bit by 0.1 million units. So not too bad overall. Tim Cook did not specifically speak about the HomePod, something a lot of people are also wondering about. We've had all those rumors that, you know, HomePod sales aren't going that well, but Apple's other category, which would include the HomePod along with Beats headphones and Apple TV and the Apple Watch and all those sorts of things, they saw its largest year-over-year percentage of revenue growth. It was actually up 38%. It was actually the one category that had the largest growth for the quarter year over year. It was followed closely then by services, which was up 31% year over year, coming in at $9.19 billion in revenue. And of course, they don't break down the numbers specifically, but in that other category, they did note that Apple Watch was growing in the double digits in terms of revenue. So Apple Watch doing very, very well in that category also. As I mentioned, services again doing very, very well, and Apple noted all-time record revenue from the App Store, Apple Music, Apple Pay, and more. And that was no doubt helped by paid subscribers to those services being up over 1 million users from a year ago. So they have a total of 270 million people paying for some sort of Apple service. If you're wondering about Apple Music, Apple commented recently that they now have 40 million paid Apple Music subscribers. Apple Pay also did very well for Apple in the services category. They say the number of users using Apple Pay worldwide doubled since last year, and transactions from Apple Pay have more than tripled. And then in the Q&A, again, Tim Cook addressed the iPhone X and its high price point. They asked him, you know, do you think that's affecting Apple sales? And once again, he had to reiterate that revenue from iPhone was up 14%. So I think that's enough said about, you know, did Apple make the right choice in raising the price point of the iPhone? Overall, the average selling price of iPhones was up for Apple in the quarter, and that was no doubt reflected in those revenue numbers. He also did go on to say, you know, the iPhone X and the high price point iPhones is not the only thing Apple is working on, that they would continue to provide different iPhones to meet different needs, all of their different kinds of customers. And we're hearing about that. We'll talk a little bit more about what's coming and expected for iPhone in 2018. And just like Apple did with the iPod when it became a mature product, they started simplifying and a little bit diversifying the kinds of iPods that you could get, right? We had everything from a Shuffle all the way through the iPod Classic and, of course, the iPod Touch on the upper echelon. And that's really what Apple needs to do across the product line to keep the numbers up, to keep revenue coming in. But once again, iPhone is no longer going to be that top sort of year-over-year massive increase in revenue. That does seem to be moving into services, as is noted by this number. Services, and also it looks like that whole other category, so some of Apple's other products, which is why I think, and again, we're going to talk about this a little bit later, why we're seeing Apple diversifying into VR and AR and the whole car project, Project Titan. They're looking to find what that next big source of revenue growth is, and you know, iPhone's not going away. It's still the largest percentage of Apple's revenue by far, but that will be changing over time, and we're going to see that happening as people upgrade less frequently, all the other things we've been talking about here on the show. But one more other thing from the earnings results call, a lot of speculation had been that Apple was having trouble in China, or has been having trouble in China. As a matter of fact, they commented that the iPhone X was the most popular smartphone in China last quarter. So, you know, overall, this was really great news, great numbers from Apple. They actually beat Wall Street expectations. The stock price has been reflecting that. So good job on them. And again, you know, we talk about this stuff on the MacCast leading into it. A lot of rumors and stuff like that. It's fun to talk about. It's fun to speculate on. But we always have to take everything with a grain of salt, because as you can see, when the actual facts come out, they can often be very different from what we're talking about. Something else that's come up recently and gotten a lot of coverage in the blogs and in our community is, two things really. What's happening with macOS and iOS, and are they eventually going to merge to become one platform? Or more specifically, are Macs and iPads going to merge into a single device running a single operating system? And there's a few different things happening. There's a couple of rumored projects that are floating around. One of those projects is called Project Marzipan, and it may or may not be called that depending upon who you believe. John Gruber came out this week and said, yeah, it was called that early on, but it's not called that anymore. And you might be wondering, well, what is that besides a food, right? Marzipan, I believe, is a food. And what it is, or actually what it isn't, is a project to merge Mac and iOS into a single operating system. I really believe that is not going to happen. It's not going to happen anytime soon. Tim Cook has been asked about it. Apple's been asked about it. Of course, they don't comment too much on that, but he has made other references to say, look, you know, we believe those things should be separate platforms. We're going to continue moving in that direction. But at the same time, one thing that is very helpful is to be able to have cross-platform apps that have feature parity, that work well together. And that has been often a challenge for developers. So what this project is there is an internal project at Apple ongoing right now, we're hearing a lot about, to try and create and make an easier way for developers to be able to write an app once and then be able to deploy it both for the touch interface system and user interface, and also for a desktop mouse and keyboard interface on the Mac. And so there is this project going on. It's an active cross-platform UI project, whether we call it Project Marzipan or something else. We'll just call it Project Marzipan for right now. That is happening, and the goal is to make it easier for developers to kind of build apps for both. The trouble right now is that you have to kind of develop and maintain separate code bases, and they use separate UI kits to actually get those things to work. And that particularly means what often happens is that developers are developing more for iPhone and iPad, and we're seeing fewer and fewer Mac applications, and Apple is wanting to change that. There's also this issue of feature parity, right? And you've probably experienced this with some apps where you might have an app on the iPad and it has more features or can do more things than it can on the Mac, or even vice versa in some cases. It really depends upon the app. So Apple's looking to change that. They're kind of trying to build a system to help address that issue. Some folks were thinking that Apple would show that off at Worldwide Developer Conference this year. John Gruber doesn't think so. He says that's going to be a 2019 thing, so expect it to arrive sometime next year. Right now, iOS uses something called UIKit for this. Mac apps use an older technology called AppKit, and ultimately, what would happen is this would be replaced with some sort of library, let's just call it UXKit at this point, that would be cross-platform and developers could leverage, so they could kind of write their application and then use a UI layer that would adapt and work on either a desktop or iOS. So that's pretty exciting, and it would help a lot with the applications. But that doesn't mean that Apple is looking ultimately to merge macOS and iOS. And this is where some of the confusion has come into play, and why I wanted to talk about it a little bit on the show, is some people are thinking this is a sign that Apple is merging the operating systems. Well, Tim Cook was asked about this by the Sydney Morning Herald recently, and he again reiterated that, quote, we don't believe in sort of watering down one or the other. And he also said, if you begin to merge the two, you begin to make trade-offs and compromises. So Apple still sees, you know, the operating systems as needing to be different. And even with this Project Marzipan, the idea here, once again, is that you still would have UI elements and things working differently depending upon the platform, they're just going to make it much easier for a developer to develop a single application that they'll be able to deploy to both platforms. And ultimately, I think that's a really, really good thing. And I still believe in that philosophy. I still believe that a touch interface needs to be a touch interface and exists like that, and that desktop interfaces need to be desktop experiences. And while there is some crossover depending upon where what you're doing, even, you know, in the example, my iPad with the smart keyboard attached, right? It works slightly differently than the iPad when I'm using it in full touch mode. But the systems adapt to that, and making it easier for developers to deal with that within their applications is ultimately a really good thing. But I do think they need to be separate experiences. And even if ultimately someday, it's not going to happen anytime soon, but someday these devices do merge into a single device, I think Apple will be better prepared to handle it using the philosophy they have now, right? Because you're still going to convert and adapt them. Think about things like convertibles, where you can detach a screen from a keyboard and your notebook now becomes a tablet. It needs to operate and function differently. So even if they ultimately merge them, this idea of having separate ways and separate UI kits to handle those things, or a single UI kit that adapts to handle those two different experiences, rather, is a good way to go. We have a few more updates this week as to what iPhone might look like in 2018. Of course, a lot of rumor and speculation here. Starting off with the iPhone SE 2. We've been talking about this recently on the MacCast. There have been rumors floating around that Apple is working on an updated version of the iPhone SE. I think that's a good thing because that's a pretty popular model. A lot of people like that 4-inch size. The latest we've been seeing are some kind of sketchy pictures, images of an iPhone SE. The big debate here is, will it have a headphone jack or not have a headphone jack? We've kind of heard and seen both things. The latest images show both options. So, you know, take, as always, these things with a grain of salt. The one kind of consistent thing about the leaks is that the iPhone SE will continue to have the same, mostly the same design, I guess I should say, with the metal band around the edge, the classic iPhone design that we've had for the past few years, but the difference being that it, instead of having a metal back, it will have a glass back to facilitate wireless charging. It will still continue to have a Touch ID sensor, and it's expected that Apple will update the processor to an A10 Fusion chip. As far as when it might arrive, some of the rumors are saying as early as May, so we may not have to wait too long to see an updated iPhone SE, and I expect the price point to remain about the same or go down slightly. So we'll have to see if those rumors come true. But if you're an iPhone SE fan, it looks like Apple may have an update for you in the near future, at least if the rumor mill is to be believed. A Barclays analyst thinks that Apple will ultimately, though, dump the 3.5-millimeter headphone adapter that was included with iPhones this year for this year's iPhone. So in 2018, you're going to get no headphone jack on the latest versions, the updates to the iPhone X and the new 6.1-inch LCD iPhone. You're going to have to deal with wireless. And if you want a headphone adapter, a Lightning to 3.5-millimeter headphone adapter, you're going to have to buy it separately. That's not great news for some folks. I know it's going to upset some people. It doesn't really bother me a bit. Since getting my AirPods, I have not missed the headphone jack one iota. And I know, again, not everybody can afford AirPods, but there are so many great Bluetooth headphone options at different price points out there now that is the way to go. And I know it doesn't solve the problem for everyone. Just know that in 2018, if you buy a new iPhone, you're going to very likely have to buy the 3.5-millimeter headphone adapter separately. As far as what the lineup is going to look like outside of the iPhone SE 2, we still have the three model lineup that is looking like it's going to be what Apple will do this year, starting with the lower price point 6.1 inch LCD iPhone. We've been talking about that quite a bit. And then you're going to have two OLED models on the upper end, a replacement for the current iPhone X, a 5.8 inch model, and then a Plus model, 6.5 inches. And I say replacing the iPhone X. There have been these rumors that Apple, once again, the iPhone X is selling not well and Apple is getting rid of it. They're going to discontinue the iPhone X. That is not really accurate. It is being replaced. It is being updated with a new iPhone. So not discontinued due to poor sales. You know, see the Q2 earnings we were talking about earlier. Let all your friends know, because I hear this over and over when I'm out in public. Hey, did you hear Apple did so badly with the iPhone X, they're discontinuing it. They are not discontinuing it. They are updating it just like they do every year, with not one, but two new models, and expect the same kinds of features, a notch, Face ID, an updated Face ID, all of that stuff. As far as the 6.1 inch LCD iPhone goes, the lower price point one, it's going to look a lot like the higher end phones, less a few features. It is going to have an edge-to-edge display. They do expect it to have the true depth camera system, the notch, and Face ID. Ming-Chi Kuo says it's going to have stronger, more durable glass, but will probably dump the 3D touch technology to keep costs down. And how affordable could the base model 6.1 inch LCD iPhone be in 2018? Some rumors are saying as low as $550 US. And I imagine at that price point, Apple will sell a ton of them. It's going to be a very popular model. Ming-Chi Kuo also thinks it's possible that in the LCD model, Apple could add a second version, a dual SIM variant. Whether or not that would be only in a market like China, because apparently that is something that very much appeals to the Chinese market. It also is something that very much appeals to world travelers and business customers. So if it'll be a separate model, if it'll be just the one model, I don't really know. I think Apple's only going to go with three models for the fall. And we've also been hearing that they might try to simplify the naming of the iPhone, with the LCD base model simply being called the iPhone, and then the 5.8 and the 6.5 inch models being the iPhone X models. And it does sound like they're going to keep the iPhone X naming. I don't know if it's going to be iPhone X and iPhone X Plus, maybe, or just simply iPhone 5.8 and 6.5 inch. We're going to have to wait until the fall to find out, but that is looking like it. We're just going to have really three iPhones, four if you count the iPhone SE, in the iPhone lineup for 2018. Worldwide Developer Conference is coming up in June, and one of the things that always gets questioned is Apple going to announce any new hardware? Typically, you would expect something like a Mac Pro, but we know that is delayed. You may also expect updated MacBook Pros, but those were updated recently. So there's been some speculation that Apple may update the MacBook Air. Well, latest reports say don't count on that happening, because Apple might be waiting on new processors from Intel before they actually do that update. DigiTimes now thinks that MacBook Air production won't actually happen until the second half of this year. Looking again at the supply chain, they do think that Apple's going to bring an even slimmer design and a Retina display to the MacBook Air, which would be a really nice update, considering that some of us, myself included, had speculated that Apple may even discontinue the MacBook Air in favor of the MacBook. But it sounds like we are going to continue to get a MacBook Air update. And I know there's a lot of MacBook Air fans out there that are going to be happy to hear that. So you'll get the latest Intel processors, a Retina display, and they're also expecting it to arrive with a price drop between $100 and $200, making it possibly start as low as $799. If Apple can hit that price point with those updates, they're going to see a ton of MacBook Airs flying off the shelves, I have to imagine, and it could be a really nice boost to Apple's Mac numbers, which, as you heard earlier, have been declining a little bit year over year. Not massively, but, you know, they are on a downward trend as, again, I think people supplement with things like iPads and even their iPhones and tend to upgrade less frequently year over year. You know, the whole dynamic at Apple is changing. You can really see it when you break down and look at the percentages of where revenue is coming from and where they're seeing the most revenue growth. Again, just a reminder, revenue growth is really happening in services and in Apple's other category. Their more mature products like iPhone, iPad, and Mac are just relatively stable in terms of year-over-year growth. They're kind of flatlining, and that's not a bad thing. You're going to hear people try and speculate that that's a bad thing. It just means that, you know, times are changing, and where Apple makes its revenue is going to change. And Apple is on top of that with all these other things that we've been talking about. So don't worry about it. But as far as Worldwide Developer Conference goes, it's not looking like we're going to see any new Mac hardware, at least not this year. A little bit of sad news if you're a follower, you're a fan of Mac and Apple rumors. Looks like Ming-Chi Kuo has called it quits. Oh no, Kuo. According to the China Times, they say that the Apple-focused analyst has left KGI Securities as of April 27th and plans to reduce his coverage of Apple. I don't know specifically what he's moving on to do, but he is not going to be doing as much Apple coverage. You know, Kuo was a great source for fairly reliable Mac rumors over the years, especially stuff coming out of Asia. What are us at Mac fans to do? Well, I guess, you know, our buddy Mark Gurman, he's going to have to step it up a little bit. Oh, he's over at Bloomberg now. So he's been pretty good. His game's always been pretty good. And I guess maybe hopefully he'll pick up the slack. Who knows if we'll find a new Apple analyst to jump in and take over for Kuo. But it's going to be sad not being able to say, and according to Ming-Chi Kuo anymore. You're going to be hearing that less and less here on the MacCast. That doesn't mean the rumors are going to be ending, though. We have latest rumors that Apple, and this is coming out of CNET, that they are working on a virtual reality headset. We had a similar report, I believe, coming from Gurman over at Bloomberg back in January. But this time, CNET says Apple has a project codenamed T-288. Sounds like a Star Wars robot, something that might be in the Solo movie or something like that. But they say Apple's working on a VR system and that it would have a standalone PC tower-like box that would be driving it. Not necessarily a Mac, but, you know, kind of a little mini computer, and it would be powered by a custom Apple 5-nanometer processor, something that's more powerful than anything that we've seen currently in any iOS devices, and something that looks a lot like a Apple-branded processor might look like if it showed up in a Mac. But they were very adamant in pointing out that this would not be a Mac box. It would be a whole separate thing specifically built to drive Apple's virtual reality headset. And that headset, it would be pretty impressive. They say the prototypes that Apple have, they're working on an 8K per eye display. So each eyeball getting an 8K display for 16K of visual goodness, and that it would be connected to that little box via a high-speed, short-range wireless technology, a 60 gigahertz technology called WiGig. I think Wi-Fi gig, WIGIG. So that's some new technology. Right now, of course, it is a research project inside Apple. And as all research projects go, it may or may not ever see the light of day. But they do think that if Apple does decide to move forward with the technology and release it as a consumer product, we wouldn't see it until 2020 at the earliest. So this is early stage development stuff. The only thing about that, I think, is that if Apple doesn't get something out in the VR space until 2020, they're very likely to hit a very crowded market with a lot of low-cost solutions. We're already seeing some of those. As a matter of fact, just this week, Oculus announced their Go platform, which is a standalone wireless virtual reality headset for $199. It doesn't require any kind of a computer, has everything built in. They're pre-selling those on Amazon, or selling them on Amazon right now. You can go buy one. I'm actually even interested in it because it looks like a great little product, and it's at a awesome price point. But Apple's going to be dealing with those sorts of things and those sorts of things 2 years in the future. So I can only imagine what an Oculus Go looks like in 2020. But that's really never stopped Apple. You know, they tend to be more about the quality of the product and the quality of the experience. And you can count on it coming out at probably a premium price if they try to go forward with it. So they will do something different. They'll do something to disrupt the space. You know, right now, VR still tends to be a little bit gimmicky. It's not quite perfect, and I think Apple's waiting, as they often do, for the perfect timing. And so this being a research project, it really doesn't come as a big surprise to me. The other thing they're saying about the headset is that it would not only be wireless, but it wouldn't have any external tracking hardware. So there's a lot of systems from some other developers that you have to kind of set up cameras in the room to track your body movements and things like that. They say Apple's working on technologies to allow that all to happen inside the headset. And as a matter of fact, we recently heard about an advanced eye tracking system that could be built into something like an Apple VR headset that would use mirrors and infrared light beams to kind of track your eye movements inside a very confined space, so they don't have to build a giant goggle system that sits on your head and kind of pulls your head down. That's one of the complaints about VR systems right now, is they tend to be kind of bulky and heavy and a little bit cumbersome to work with. And as a matter of fact, we're also hearing that this VR headset could also possibly be a mix of augmented reality and VR in the same system. So Apple looking into lots of stuff in this space. And again, it's one of those potential growth areas that we're moving into as we move more and more away from traditional computer interfaces into voice-driven interfaces and VR, AR interfaces. You know, Apple wants to be on the forefront of that stuff. So I don't find any of these projects surprising. Will these things make it to market as consumer products? I think eventually they will. I think this is where things are going. And a lot of the stuff is kind of experimental at this point. But you can count on Apple being really focused on making sure that it's a viable consumer product when and if they release it. And that's kind of the big difference. A lot of the other stuff, I think, that comes out, people rushing to market, they don't really know where this technology is going. They just know it's cool, and it's fun to see that too. But that's just not the way that Apple operates. But anyway, Apple is working on VR, and that's kind of the latest that we know about it. All right, this is some bad news. If you're a fan of AirPort, it is now official. Apple is getting out of the wireless router game. They are discontinuing AirPort. They told iMore, yep, we are done. An Apple spokesperson said, we are discontinuing the Apple AirPort base station products. They will be available through Apple.com. in Apple's retail stores and at Apple authorized resellers while supplies last. But if you want an AirPort Extreme or an AirPort Express or something like that, you better buy it now and hold on to it. You might want to stock up if that's your favorite router, because Apple is not going to be making them anymore. We sort of already knew this back in 2016. Bloomberg reported that Apple had assigned many, if not all, of its AirPort team onto other projects, so they weren't really in active development. And Apple has not updated their AirPort lineup since about 2013. So not that that means much, because Mac Pro, right, that hasn't been updated, and Apple is going to do an update to that. Along with this announcement, Apple added a support article, and I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com, with their tips on transitioning away from AirPort routers into other routers. Basically, they're telling you what to look for if you're considering buying another router that's not an AirPort. They say you want 802.11 AC or probably newer technology moving forward, dual band support in the router, WPA2 personal encryption, and either a MIMO or MU MIMO router. So those are kind of the key systems. And as far as what Apple is now going to sell in their retail stores, they're currently offering a mesh system from Linksys called Velop. So that's kind of the one they're backing. There are a lot of options out there. We're going to talk in a little bit about what things you might want to consider if you're looking to replace your AirPort. I had a number of questions, as you might imagine, this week come into the MacCast from you asking my opinion on that. So we'll get into that in just a bit. But I want to finish up the news here. We have one more story to get to, and that is a battery replacement program if you own a non-touch bar 13-inch MacBook Pro. Apple announced a new battery replacement program for those units. They've determined that a limited number of 13-inch MacBook Pro non-touch bar units have a component that may cause the built-in battery to start to expand, which is never a good thing. So you're going to want to get that replaced if you have an affected unit. Affected units were manufactured between October 2016 and October 2017. Eligibility for the program is determined by your product's serial number. So you can go to the support article. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. And there is a little checker there. You can plug in your serial number and it will tell you if you have a MacBook in the affected range. If you qualify, you can have the replacement done at an Apple authorized service provider. You can take it into a retail store, although just know that they may actually send it out to an Apple repair center, so you might be without your computer for a bit, or you can mail it directly yourself to an Apple repair center. Just go through AppleCare support online to get that all set up and scheduled. I think they'll even send you out like a box and a shipping label and all that stuff. So they're going to take care of you if you have one of those affected units. If you have an affected unit and you happened to have already paid for a new battery to get your battery replaced, you can contact Apple also to get a refund on that. And this program is going to cover affected units for 5 years from the date of purchase. So if you don't have the problem immediately, it will still be covered up to 5 years. Just note that this doesn't extend any of your other AppleCare coverage. So any other component parts are still covered by your standard AppleCare, whether you got the standard year or you paid for AppleCare Plus and added an additional year on. That is not going to get extended. This is just a special program covering the batteries in non-touch bar 13-inch MacBook Pros. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Smile. I want to talk to you again about Text Expander, but this time I want to talk to you about Text Expander if you have a team that you're working with. Text Expander can actually multiply your team's productivity by making up-to-date shared knowledge available instantly to everyone in your organization who needs it. Using Text Expander with Teams, you can set up common responses that are going to be accessible by everybody on your team. Not only accessible, but searchable using simple abbreviations and keyboard shortcuts. You can also have your communications written and edited by your best writers and then shared with the rest of your team. And it's all available on multiple platforms. So whatever platform your organization uses or the people in your organizations use, even if it's different ones, macOS, iOS, Windows, or web, they're all going to be able to access the same snippets and the same Text Expander responses and things like that. And they get updated immediately and everywhere when they're modified. It's all synced. So if you're on a support or sales team, if you're in legal, medical, or real estate, and you want to unify your communication and make sure it's consistent and accurate and also relevant, Text Expander can really change your life. It leaves you with more time to focus on your business and not have to worry as much about that daily communication and the stuff that you send out. Of course, Text Expander is also great for personal use, and you should check it out for that. One tip I have for you is setting it up to deal with common typos. I have a few things just with my typing style where I'm mistyping the same thing all of the time. What I've done is set up little correction snippets for that. So download is a common one. For some reason, I mistype the O and the A and I transpose those. I just set up a little Text Expander snippet with the shortcut with the misspelled version of download, and it auto corrects to download every time. So I never make that typo ever again. There's actually a great article on this on the Text Expander blog. They have great tips and tricks. I'll link to this in the show notes at maccast.com that talks about setting this up. Another thing that I have is accented words. Text Expander has an accented words shared public snippet group that anybody can tap into, and you never have to remember those fancy, you know, how do I type an umlaut, or how do I put the little squiggly line over my N. I don't have to worry about what those keyboard shortcuts are anymore for most common accented words, because I just have the shared snippet group that automatically corrects those. And I can add to that anytime when I find one that doesn't already exist. So it's a great product. Best of all, if you visit textexpander.com/podcast right now, you're going to get 20% off your first year of Text Expander. So you get a great discount on a great product. Check it out, textexpander.com/podcast. And a huge thank you to Smile for their continued support of the MacCast. Guess what I found out this week? There are a lot of you out there who are still rocking the cheese grater, the old Tower Mac Pro. A couple shows back, we've been talking about this recently, there was the announcement that Apple would not be bringing out their updated Mac Pro this year. I talked about that on the podcast, and I started to ask the community, you know, what do you think about this? Is this a big deal? And I got quite a bit of feedback from Pro Mac users in our community that they were not really bothered by the announcement of the new Mac Pro system being delayed, which was surprising to me because I was personally, and you probably heard this on the show, pretty upset about it. I thought it was a huge deal, and I was mainly upset not because I'm actually a Mac Pro user. I don't own a Mac Pro. Well, technically, I kind of do. We'll talk about that here in a second, but it's not my daily driver. I don't use a Mac Pro every day, but I know, and I've heard from members of the community over the years who are Mac Pro customers, and generally, they've not been happy with how long they've had to wait between machines. So the idea that Apple had announced this machine like last year, said they were working on it along with a new Pro display, and for them to come out then and say, nope, it's going to still be another year on a machine that had already gone 5 years, 6 years without an update, that was upsetting to me. But I guess I was one of the rare people in that camp. What I'm learning is that there tends to be kind of two kinds of pro users. And some pros are a little bit more pro than other pros. And if you're more in the, I don't want to call it casual because I don't want to undermine, you know, what pros are doing. There's a whole range of pro uses. But if you're more on your own, like you're a freelancer, maybe you're a photographer, maybe you are an audio engineer, somebody working by yourself, and you don't have a lot of money to spend on a system, you're buying a system, you need it to last for a long time, and you need it to be able to be upgradable. But maybe you want a new machine every 4 or 5 years. Those folks are kind of the ones that are a little more upset about this announcement. The rest of the pros, the people who are working more on the higher end of the industry, so in film or in really high-end 3D applications or science or technology, they don't seem to be quite as bothered by this. And Apple seems to feel that Pro systems, as far as the towers go, are maybe more for that upper pro market. As a matter of fact, they said one of the reasons for the delay is they've been talking a lot to those folks, and they're looking at workflows as much as what the technology is. So how can they improve with the technology and what they're putting into the systems, the workflow for those higher-end customers? And that's the system they're looking to try and build. And it might be why I think the iMac Pro is a system that seems to have fulfilled the need for the other level of pro users, at least in the short term. So we're seeing things like folks who are into pro photography, maybe people who are doing YouTube stuff or vlogging, podcasters, digital artists and stuff like that, gravitating toward the iMac Pro as this interim solution. So they might have a Mac Pro tower now, maybe a trash can or a cheese grater, and they're seriously considering and even buying the iMac Pro to fulfill that need. But those folks on the higher end, the people who really absolutely need a modular system, turns out they've been waiting. And one of the folks I heard from was MacCast Patreon supporter Keith. He hit me up in the show channel in the MacCast Slack and said he's still using a 2008 2.8 gigahertz Mac Pro, and it's totally fine. He absolutely loves it. And why can he get by with that system in 2018, almost 10 years later? It's because that system is upgradable. Those cheese graters can really be expanded. He said over the years, he's slowly done things like max out the RAM, add additional storage to all the drive bays. He didn't do it on day one because he couldn't afford it, but over the years, he's been slowly upgrading the machine. He also added a Mercury Excelsior E2 PCI SSD drive. This is basically solid state flash that's on a PCI card. They're sold by Mac Sales, OWC rather. And that's his main drive. And he said by putting that in, the entire thing felt like a brand new system. And we know that an SSD upgrade is, if you want to do any upgrade to really increase the performance of an old Mac, switching from a traditional spinning drive to a solid state drive is the thing to do. It really is amazing. But he did that. He added a new graphics card that quadrupled the graphics power of the original and can now run a 3-monitor setup. He added Wi-Fi and Bluetooth cards to upgrade that. So he's running Bluetooth 4.0. Also added in a card for additional USB 3 connectors. So basically upgraded the entire system over the years, and was even able to run High Sierra on it. Now, technically, the 2008 Mac Pro is not supported by High Sierra, but there is a thing out there called Collins Patch Tool. You have to do a little bit of a hacking, and of course, it's not officially supported by Apple, but he said, I got it running, and it wasn't too tricky, and it works, and it's made my machine really work in the modern age. And of course, all this stuff sound expensive, and it is, but you have to realize these improvements were made slowly over time, one at a time. So you invest a little bit of money in each year into improving and upgrading your existing Mac, and eventually you have a system that works really, really well. And as I said earlier, this got me thinking because I recently inherited a 2009 Mac Pro. It's sitting over in the corner. I wanted it just because I think it's a great classic design, but now, because you have emailed in and there's a number of people talking about these upgrades, I am now thinking, hey, maybe I should play around with this a little bit. So you might hear some stuff on future episodes of the MacCast about taking an old Mac Pro system and bringing it into the modern age. And I'm bringing this up because I think folks out there often, I know I didn't think about that. And so if you are in that range of, I know I have my current Mac Pro, I really want to buy a new one, Apple's not bringing one out, this may be there may be some things in here that you can do in the interim to get your system up to date. So thanks, Keith, for mentioning that stuff. I thought that was pretty cool. And it does sound like that's how a lot of the pros are surviving until, I guess, now 2019, when Apple brings out that new system. And I expect that new modular system to be completely amazing. I think it really is going to blow us all away once it finally hits the market. With Apple announcing the death of the AirPort, I am now getting asked more and more via emails and Twitter and stuff like that from the community, what am I going to do when I need to buy or replace my current AirPort? Or, hey, I was thinking about buying an AirPort, but doesn't seem to make sense now since Apple's not going to be supporting it. What should I buy or what am I going to do? And you know, the news is a little bit upsetting because the AirPort, if you are all in on Apple and Mac, it really is a great router that just sort of works. You don't have to think about it too much. You don't have to tweak it. You plug it in. It's plug and play. It's really designed to work with all of your Apple stuff. And third-party routers, as great as they are, and there's lots of great options out there, they haven't traditionally always worked like that. That was one of the reasons Apple initially got into, well, backing up even further, Apple originally produced the AirPort because they really pioneered wireless technology, not in terms of, you know, building it and designing it, but being one of the first companies to really push it and support it, a lot like they did with USB. And at the time, there weren't a lot of options for wireless routers, so Apple sort of had to make one to go with the original iBook. If you remember the iBook with the handle, and a lot of people call it, not unflatteringly, the toilet seat iBook. I thought it was a great design and a really cool clamshell system. But anyway, in that iBook, that was what the first thing to have AirPort. So Apple built their AirPort routers, and they just continued to make them over time. And they've worked really, really great. And so what are you going to do now if you need a new wireless router? Well, first and foremost, the good news is you have time. If you are currently an AirPort user, you have an AirPort Extreme, especially if it's anything built in the last couple of generations, I think you're totally fine. Existing AirPort Extremes, existing time capsules, they're now 5 years old, but I think they should last at least a few more years. I think Apple will continue to put out software updates for them, specifically security updates. I don't expect any big new features, but yeah, they're going to be all right. If you have a time capsule, you might want to consider replacing it sooner than later, because again, it has a spinning hard drive in it, and that hard drive is now 2, 3, 4, you know, depending upon when you purchased your time capsule. It's going to start to show its age. And we know it's with hard drives, it's not a matter of if they will fail. It is when are they going to fail. So, you know, there are a decent number of, if you have a time capsule system, there are a decent number of network attached storage systems now that support Time Machine systems from Synology, Drobo, Western Digital, and they will work with Time Machine backups over the network, and they do work pretty well. In the early days, it was pretty kludgy to get those other systems working, and really the time capsule was your only option if you wanted something that just worked. But that has improved over time. Just do some research before you totally invest in a NAS or a network attached system to work with Time Machine that's not a time capsule. Make sure it is really going to work for your situation, but there are options out there. So you don't have to worry about that. But that gets us to the question of, you know, what do I buy if I want to replace my my AirPort? And really, these days, you kind of have two options. You have traditional third-party routers, Wi-Fi routers that are kind of single routers, and then you have these new mesh systems from a number of the companies. And so what I wanted to talk about was really, how do I know if I need a mesh system or if I can go with just kind of a standard router? And if I make either of those decisions, what are some recommended brands? You know, what should I be looking at in terms of features and those sorts of things? So I want to start with that first question. Do I need mesh? Do I need a mesh router system, wireless router? And I would say it depends on a number of factors. Most importantly, probably how your space is laid out. You know, what are you trying to cover? And have you typically found in the past that with your house, with your layout, whatever space you're trying to cover, that you have dead zones with your existing AirPort or router? And have you had to turn to tricks like using extenders or bridges to kind of get those areas covered? And if the answer to that question is yes, I have this weird space, I have dead zones, then mesh is probably something you really want to look into. The advantage of mesh is that each access point, unlike extenders and bridges, which don't work very well, each access point is really a first-class citizen in your network. It's not just a little slave that's kind of pushing along the signal. And, you know, when you do that with a bridge, you actually lose speed. You lose bandwidth. You don't get that with a mesh system. All of the access points work together to kind of create a cloud or a mesh of coverage throughout your house. So they are working together to better distribute the bandwidth throughout your house, and they'll manage what devices are connected to any one access point, and they can kind of actively push things around to the right to another access point if things get overloaded. So they're a much smarter system than just using dumb extenders and repeaters. And so if you have a large space, if you have an awkward space, those are kind of prime candidates for getting a mesh router system. You have a lot of walls and obstacles you need to get around. What you can do is put the mesh units in kind of a line of sight of each other, right? You can map them out in a way that you can get around those walls and obstacles. You can move into those other spaces and do it pretty effectively. As far as coverage areas, there's no hard and fast rules, but I believe most mesh access points will kind of cover a space of about 1,000 square feet. So again, if you have a large space, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 square feet, a mesh can work really, really well because you can cover multiple rooms or multiple areas with multiple units. And how you do that is going to kind of vary by manufacturer. So you're going to have to check with whatever brand you end up buying, but they work really, really well. Mesh can also help if your access point, where your internet service is coming into your house, is not centralized. So if you have kind of the cable modem or your DSL router at one end of the house, you know it can be a challenge to get Wi-Fi coverage all the way maybe to the other side of the house. A mesh system can help with that because, again, you can place those things in a line, starting with the main entry point for your internet into your house and then move things along. So that's another great situation where you might want to consider a mesh system. And the good news now is there's lots of mesh Wi-Fi options from company or mesh router systems from companies like Eero. Linksys has their Velop system, which is what Apple's selling in the retail stores. Netgear has a system called Orbi. There's Ubiquiti and TP-Link, Deco, and a few others out there. And it can get a little bit confusing because it's like with so many brands and so many different options, you know, how you know which one to buy. And generally, they all work pretty much the same. You're going to have certain features that differ, maybe cloud features and things like that, the number of radios, the number of antennas. But in general, most people are going to be okay with a system that has two by two radios. So you're going to want to look at the number of radios in there. And that's basically the number of antennas that can kind of pick up signals and talk to the devices on your network. In most cases, two by two is going to be fine. Where that differs is if you have a ton of clients, and by clients, I mean devices. So if you have, you know, a million Internet of Things, if you're totally invested in home automation, think of all of the things, and you might even want to, because I forget how many devices I have that connect to my Wi-Fi network. But if you might want to make a list, you know, I have a Sonos system, I have my HomeKit devices, I have a number of Macs and iPads in the family, I have, you know, a million other Internet of Things devices, I have Arduinos and Raspberry Pis and all this sort of stuff. So if you have a lot of client devices, and more these days, we're all getting more, then you might want to upgrade to a system that has more radios in it. So 2 3x3, or they even have 2 4x4 systems now. So that is one thing to consider. Of course, the more radios you get, the more expensive your mesh system is going to be. So just be prepared for that. And already the mesh systems are going to be a little bit more expensive, or tend to be a little bit more expensive than a single router system. Another nice feature to look for is either Ethernet or, in some cases, what's called wireless backhaul. And what that means is an ability to actually hardwire the mesh units to each other with an Ethernet cable. Not all of the systems support that. And like I said, some systems are starting to use an additional radio to do that wirelessly. So it kind of has a dedicated signal for going from point to point between two mesh units. And the reason you might want that is if you have to spread your mesh units out over a long distance. So a great example of this is if you have an outbuilding and you're trying to get from a mesh unit that might be centrally located in your house, and then you have to go a large distance to an outbuilding, having an Ethernet backhaul where you can actually run a cable to extend that mesh network to another zone can be a really good thing. So that's something to consider. As far as pricing goes, generally most mesh systems these days are going to run you in the range of between $200 to $400 US, and that depends on the number of units, but that's typically for a 2 to 3 unit setup, depending upon the features and depending upon the brand. The good news is, like I said, there's a lot of companies entering this space, so it's pretty competitive, and prices are coming down pretty quickly, and features are getting extended pretty quickly, and there's often deals that you can find. So just if you're in the market for one of these mesh systems, be on the lookout for that. If you're looking for some specific recommendations, I am a big fan of the Eero, especially the second generation system, for ease of setup and ease of use. You know, for somebody who's coming from that airport experience, I think Eero kind of recreates that the best, at least with the different systems that I've tested. Of course, I do need to caveat that with the fact that Eero was a sponsor of the MacCast. They're not currently, and they did provide a system to me. So just be aware of that. But, you know, really, I've tried a few of these things. And as far as setup goes, Eero works really, really great. I also like the design because they're very low profile and they kind of don't stick out. Some of the other systems kind of have these tower units and they're a little more obvious. So if you care about design, Eero has a little bit of an advantage there. A system I haven't tried, but I've been told by many, many geeks who like to tweak all of the various aspects of their Wi-Fi system and like a lot of controls and knobs and settings to go with. If you like that sort of thing, you might want to look at the Ubiquiti system. They apparently have the ability to tweak a lot of things. As I mentioned before, the kind of Apple blessed system at this point is the Linksys Velop. So that may be worth looking at. And if you're on a budget, if you're looking for a great system at kind of a budget price, a great mesh system, my friend Dave Hamilton over at the Mac Observer, he really likes the TP-Link Deco system. So you might want to look at that. I looked up some pricing on Amazon this week, and you can get a three-pack system of the TP-Link Deco for about $228 US, that compared to, say, like an Eero system, which is going to run you more in the range of like $300 or $400. So if you're looking to save some money and you still want to go with mesh, that's worth looking at. So that's kind of the breakdown on mesh systems. For smaller spaces or a house where you can kind of more centrally locate a router, a mesh system might actually be overkill, and you can probably go with a single unit, good old, you know, Wi-Fi router. And there are now some awesome dual and tri-band systems out there at a pretty affordable price. They can provide a lot of coverage, and they tend to cost about the same as an Airport Extreme. Yes, you can get some lower cost Wi-Fi routers that maybe have fewer or less features, but again, remember, we're talking about people who are looking to replace an Airport Extreme. In that case, when you're looking at routers, I think you want to still look in that about $200 price range, and there are some really great options out there right now to look into. I myself, if I were to buy a new router, single unit router for myself, I'd probably be buying a Synology RT2600 AC. It is a great, I think it's a dual band system. There are other good choices from companies like Netgear, the R7000P, and also I've heard really good things about the ASUS system. They make a few models, but kind of the popular one is the ASUS RT-AC 3200. I know the names of routers are not as cool as Airport or Airport Extreme. So do a little bit of research. The one thing I'll say about the Synology, for those of you who might be looking to replace a time capsule, the Synology RT2600 AC, it has some USB ports on the back, and it does have Time Machine compatibility. So you can plug in a USB-C hard drive to the back of that thing, and then you can back up wirelessly using Time Machine to that that hard drive. So if you're in the market for that sort of thing, that would be worth looking at. So that's kind of my general thoughts on replacing an airport. I think we're going to be hearing a lot more about this in our community over the coming weeks and months because of Apple discontinuing the airports. If you have some thoughts and opinions on this, if you have a system that you particularly like and want to share your ideas with us and information, please send me some email, maccast@gmail.com. Going to do a little tech potpourri now. I have one thing that I want to talk to you about, but I want to start off with a couple of questions that I received from Brian.
Hi, Adam. Brian from New Jersey. Hoping you or the community can help two issues. I've been doing some searching and not finding anything. First one is maybe the simplest. It's my airport. It blinks yellow once per week. I unplug it and restart it, and it's back to green. I don't know if it's a big problem or an indication of crash and burn time or what. But it's really and truly almost exactly to the minute 1 week every time I re-plug it. Just wondering about that one. The other one is I made a backup. I got left my job, had a backup of all my computer stuff, bought a new computer, used the image from my work computer to set up the new computer because it had all my stuff on it. And I keep getting this message about a server not being available, which, of course, is not going to be available. It's on my former work network, and I'm not there anymore. So I don't know how to stop it. I've tried and I've searched, like I said, but can't find anything to stop it. Keep doing what you're doing. Love it. Thanks very much.
Hey, Brian, I think we can help you out with both of these questions. I'm going to start off with the airport thing. I would recommend that the next time that thing starts blinking, I guess in about a week or so, that you go onto your Mac or an iOS device and open up the airport utility, because then you'll be able to see why it's actually blinking. Typically, an amber flashing light on the front of an airport means that the Wi-Fi base station has detected some sort of condition that requires your attention. It's basically its way of saying, hey, I have a problem. But it could be any number of problems. And really, the only way to find out is to use Airport Utility. So you can open up Airport Utility on your Mac. You're going to find it in the Applications Utilities folder. And then in the Airport Utility window, you're going to want to locate that Wi-Fi base station that's having the trouble. You're going to want to double click on it to open up the summary window. And then when the summary window appears, you're going to want to double click on the little amber circle to the right of the Wi-Fi base station status, and that will open up the status window. And then in the status window, it is going to list the reason why it's asking for your attention. And there might be multiple reasons, and you're going to have to kind of respond to and deal with each one to try and figure out how to troubleshoot it. If you run into any trouble with that, just follow up with me if you don't really know what it's trying to tell you. I do know that a very common issue that will cause the little amber light to flash is something called a double NAT, network address translation. NAT is what actually translates the addresses on the internet to the local addresses on your network. And you can only have one device on your network that is doing that network address translation. If you have more than one, there can be a conflict and things get confused. And typically you want your router, probably the airport, to be the NAT device. And that's probably how you have it set up. But it's possible, depending upon the modem that was provided by your cable company. I don't know if you've purchased your own or if there was one provided by your cable company or your internet service provider, if you have DSL or something like that. It might also have network address translation turned on that box, and you might have to go in or figure out how to go in and disable that if you are in a double NAT situation. And again, in that status window, it'll say, hey, you're double NATed. You have two network address translations going on, and I'm confused. It could be something else, but that definitely will be known if you use the airport utility. So that's how you can troubleshoot that. Sorry, I don't have a full answer for you, but that should get you pointed in the right direction. On the other topic, that server that it keeps trying to connect to because you cloned basically your business computer to your home computer, I'm going to go out on a limb and guess that at some point, one of the IT folks in your company went in and set it up so that those volumes would auto mount when you boot your Mac. And the way you do that is you just basically add the drives into your login items under your user account. So to undo that, all you would have to do is go into your system preferences, click on users and groups, and then select your user account and then click on the login items tab. And I bet you if you look in that list on the left, you're going to see those server volumes that it's trying to mount to sitting there in the list. And so all you have to do is select those volumes in that interface and then click the little minus icon to remove it. You may have to enter your admin password, click the little lock in the interface. I don't remember if it'll allow you to add or remove before you do that. But basically, if you just remove that from your login items, then when you boot up your Mac, you shouldn't see it trying to actually auto connect to those volumes and ask you for the passwords anymore. So hopefully that resolves your two issues. Again, if not, follow up with me. If anybody else in the community has any ideas on either of these things, of course, as always, share your opinions with us, maccast@gmail.com. One other little issue I want to bring up, or a little bit of troubleshooting that I've been dealing with for a while now, and I found a solution to that was unexpected, I want to share with you. I was having this issue with my MacBook Pro and the fans constantly running at almost full speed, 6,000 RPMs. I use iStat menus to kind of monitor the fan speed and the processor temperatures and stuff like that. And I was having this issue where the fans would kick in full blast. And oftentimes coinciding with that, when I looked at Activity Monitor, I would see my kernel task, which is kind of the main task that runs on your Mac, spinning up and using about 500% of my processor, and I'd start to get beach balls and everything would slow down. It was becoming an epidemic problem on my Mac. It was happening every day. Even my wife started commenting that when I was away from my computer, hey, your fans are spinning full blast. What's going on? And I tried everything to troubleshoot this. I did all the typical fixes, rebooting, zapping the PRAM, resetting the system management controller to try and, you know, find out if there was something wrong with the power management system. I did everything troubleshooting wise I could think of. And then I was talking to Dave Hamilton, and he kind of mentioned that, you know, the kernel task thing can happen if the Mac is either overheating or thinking it's going into an overheating situation. And I guess the idea is it tries to kind of claim the processor from other processes in an attempt to try and get it under control and slow things down and get the computer to kind of self-cool itself. What was odd, though, was when I was looking at the CPU temperatures and the GPU temperatures, they didn't really seem too hot when this situation was kicking in, about 150 degrees Fahrenheit. So that led us to believe that maybe the sensor was sort of malfunctioning and that was causing the problem. But that, at the same time, also got me thinking. And then another event actually happened to kind of get me thinking even further. And that was suddenly I have a Drobo that sits under my desk, and the Drobo started doing the same thing. The fans were running out of control, and it got so bad that it was actually impacting the podcast, because you could kind of hear, and you may hear this on some of the episodes a little while back, the fans running a little bit. And I would go to be a guest on shows and they would even comment on it. Hey, someone's fans are running, and it turned out to be my fans. Well, that got me looking at the Drobo, and I kind of pulled the cover off, and what I noticed was dust bunnies, like big ones in there. And I thought, you know what, that dust can really work almost like an insulation, and that will kind of keep the heat in. And I realized I had to do a little bit of cleanup. So I cleaned the dust off of my my Drobo, kind of pulled that out of there, used some compressed air to blow things out and clean that off. And sure enough, once I did that, the Drobo was running better. And I thought, aha, maybe I have a similar issue with the MacBook Pro. So I took the time, I removed the back cover, and sure enough, big giant dust bunnies, especially in and around the fans. So I was able to actually, with tweezers, actually pull out big chunks of dust very, very carefully, of course, when you have your MacBook Pro open, and also very carefully with a can of compressed air, blow the dust out of that, out of the fans, out of the vents. I even got a kind of stiff paintbrush, and some of the fans were really crusted with some of that dust, and I cleaned all of it out, made it pristine and brand new. Again, you're going to want to statically ground yourself if you're getting in there. You got to be very careful about static electricity when you're working, blowing around compressed air and stuff like that. So be careful when you're doing this stuff. But I cleaned all of that out, and sure enough, since doing that, I have not had the issues of the fans spinning up. Everything seems to be working much, much better now. And I don't know why I didn't think of it earlier, which is exactly why I'm bringing it up to you. If you're running into this problem where you're getting beach balls, fans are spinning, and you've tried all of the standard kind of troubleshooting, you might consider just doing a little clean out of your computer, especially the vents and the fans and the cooling system. Get the cooling system back working efficiently the way it should. Now, unfortunately, also when I got in to look at my MacBook Pro, I noticed the batteries are looking a little bit puffy, and that could be caused by the overheating. Batteries and heat don't work very well, so I may be looking at having to get a battery replacement. I actually have an Apple Genius Bar appointment set up to go in and look in that. So we'll see what they say. I will update you on that issue, but it certainly did resolve my other problem. So, you know, as always, consider cleaning your stuff out from time to time. I obviously failed to do that, and learn from my mistakes and don't make the same mistakes that I do. But just a couple little quick tips and things to think about this week. All right. Another email I received this week came from David, and he had a question about Apple Music and more specifically sharing a single Apple Music account. He said he and his wife, you know, he's not so much concerned about the cost, but she doesn't listen to a lot of music and he didn't really see the value in buying an Apple Music family subscription. So they just have a single subscription that they share. They share that and they share their iTunes account. And it's never really been a big deal until recently. He and his wife, they both listen to different playlists, and they've been able to do that at the same time, so long as one playlist was actually downloaded locally. So they could play a local playlist, and then someone could be streaming a playlist off Apple Music. But more recently, he said, he found if his wife is streaming Apple Music, and this does appear to be a change that Apple made in the software or something like that, he said if she's listening to Apple Music streaming, and he tries to listen to one of his playlists that is actually local on his device, he'll get a pop-up message saying that he can't do that, that basically you can only have one stream going, or that someone else is currently listening to Apple Music and you can only listen to one device at a time. And that actually is part of the Apple Music single plan. You're only allowed to have one device streaming at a time. The exception to this now is the HomePod. The HomePod does not count against your streaming limit, but that is a limitation. And David's been able to kind of work around this new change by either turning off Wi-Fi or putting the phone into airplane mode. That'll allow him to listen offline, and then kind of the device doesn't report back to Apple. And so it doesn't know, hey, his wife is streaming and he's listening at the same time. But he was curious, you know, why has Apple made this change? And are there other people who have run into this issue? Of course, if you have a family plan, you may or may not be aware. So I guess I shouldn't say of course, but if you have a family plan, you can get six simultaneous streams going. So obviously one workaround around this is to buy a family subscription, and then David, your wife and yourself can stream at the same time, and it's not going to be an issue. That does mean you're going to have to pay $14.99 a month instead of $9.99 a month, so a little bit more. But once again, David wrote, you know, his wife doesn't listen all that frequently, so it doesn't seem to, he can't seem to justify, you know, paying the additional cost for that. So all I can do is say your workaround is probably the thing that you're going to have to do. As far as why did Apple make the change, I have no way of really knowing. I can speculate on that. My guess is that part of it has to do with the deal that they have with the record labels, but that may or may not be the case. And I say may or may not because, you know, Apple does have to pay the record labels and the artists per stream that you listen to. So technically, if you have two people listening on a single Apple Music account, you're kind of doubling the amount of streams potentially that you would be using. And that means for that $9.99, you know, Apple's done some math. They've tried to figure out, okay, if we charge you $9.99 a month, the typical person listens to X number of streams, and we have to pay out X per stream or Y per stream. And, you know, they do all the math to figure out the most cost-effective price point to price your plan at. And so they're going to get less revenue, and that may be a problem. So there's kind of this optimal thing, and they've decided, well, that means if you're on a single plan, you can only stream to one device at a time, and that's how we mitigate that. And you might say, well, you know, if I'm listening to downloaded music offline, I'm not streaming, so what's the big deal? Well, the reality is that Apple still has to pay a per stream or a per listen price for the stuff that you've even downloaded. And I think they also have to pay an additional charge to allow you to download that to listen offline. I found one source, and I haven't been able to confirm this, that says even when you're playing offline, what happens is they track those plays and those tracks. And then once you're reconnected to the internet, it transmits that data back to Apple so that they can account for that, and they can remit the revenue that they're supposed to the record labels and the artists. This is how artists get paid for streaming music. And if you know a little bit about the controversy, you know, there's a lot of artists complaining that streaming music, they actually make less than when you actually purchase music. So there's that whole debate going on. So we want artists to be able to get paid for every stream that gets listened to. And if that's how the revenue is being generated, then you can imagine that it makes sense for Apple to want to limit the number of streams that any one person can play, because that's just how the revenue model works. So I'm guessing that it has something to do with that. It probably also has something a little bit to do with the licensing deal that Apple has with the record labels. I don't know for sure. I'm just speculating on this, but logically, that seems to be what makes sense to me. Now, I'm also bringing this up because if my understanding or my logical conclusion of that is not the reality, and you happen to know the real reason why Apple has these restrictions, you have some sort of insider information, maybe you work in the music industry, you work with Apple, and can let us know, send me an email, mattcast@gmail.com, and I will share an updated bit of information on a future podcast. But David, that's my guess, and hopefully that kind of helps answer your question this week. All right, finally, another little Apple Music thing related to HomePod for you. This came in an email from Steve, who wrote in because he's a new HomePod owner, and he noticed something odd when he was using the Now Playing app on his Apple Watch with his HomePod. A little background, one of the reasons he said he bought the HomePod versus a Sonos One system that would work with Alexa was that he figured the HomePod has the ability to use the Apple Watch Siri face and the Now Playing feature to be able to actually control the music that's on the HomePod. So you can look at your watch, you can see what's playing on the HomePod, you can control the volume, you can skip forward, skip back, and that's handy if you happen to be off in another area of the house, maybe too far away from the HomePod to issue a Siri voice command. Although, you know, the voice commands work from a pretty far distance. So anyway, but the point is that Steve is like, this is a feature I want. I want to be able to control my HomePod from my Apple Watch. The trouble was, the first time he tried it, it didn't work. He had asked Siri to play some music on the HomePod, and then he looked at his Apple Watch, the Now Playing app, and the information didn't show up. He didn't have control over it. And at the time, he didn't think too much about it. He didn't have time to go into troubleshooting, and he just kind of let it go. Then later, he was actually on his iPhone playing music, AirPlaying it to the HomePod, and he noticed, sure enough, that, oh, the controls for the HomePod did show up in the Now Playing app on his watch. And so then he tried again, starting the music directly, streaming from Apple Music on the HomePod, and again, wasn't able to access the HomePod controls from the Now Playing thing on his watch. And so what he realized was that it works when you're doing AirPlay to the HomePod from an iPhone or an iOS device, but it does not work if you start the music directly streaming from the HomePod. And his question was, why? You know, why is this not working? Both the watch and the HomePod are wireless devices. They're on the same wireless network. You would think this would be something that Apple could do. And it was a little bit frustrating to him to discover this, given the fact that it was one of the main reasons he went with the HomePod. And Steve, I looked into this a little bit. I played around with my Apple Watch. I found it a little bit surprising that this feature wasn't supported. And the answer is Apple, I think, feels the same way, because the reality is it's just a feature they haven't implemented yet. And the reason I know this is because this week, watchOS 4.3 beta came out. And I was going to install it, and I was looking at the release notes because I like to see what the new features they've added are. And sure enough, the very first item in the list was, quote, control volume and playback on HomePod from your Apple Watch. So the good news I can tell you is that it's coming. The bad news is it's not until the next version of watchOS comes out, but you will be able to do it. And I played around with this a little bit, and it works just as expected. On the watch, when you're in the now playing screen up in the upper left hand corner, you will now see the source, or I think you currently see the source, but the difference is now you can tap on that source and it will allow you to switch between controlling the music on your iPhone from the Apple Watch now playing, or controlling the music on your HomePod if you have both. So you can switch back and forth between them. I would imagine would also allow you to control music that might be playing, say, on an Apple TV as well, although I haven't played around or tested that quite yet. And just for anybody who might not remember, you can, through the player on the iPhone, control the HomePod or your iOS device by going into the control center and force pressing or tap and holding on the player controls in the control center. And then you can bring up the little, I call them cards, but basically the various audio controllers, and you can switch. If you have a HomePod going, you'll see the HomePod options, and you'll also see the one for the Apple TV. You can move it back and forth, and you can tap the one that you want. And once you've tapped that, then whichever one is currently selected is going to be what appears in the control center. And then, of course, you can force press and switch back and forth between them again. So a couple cool little tips for controlling music, both from the iPhone and hopefully in the future from your Apple Watch if you have a HomePod. So Steve, thanks for those questions, and I hope that answers it for you. Okay, with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. I have a quick message for those of you who are Patreon supporters of the MacCast. This week, I finally got around to and fired up the RSS feed, the RSS audio for Patreon. I posted a little bit about it on the Patreon website, and you may have got a notification about that. I did make a little bit of a mistake, so I want to explain how the audio feed works. I had posted a link to the audio feed, and it turns out what I posted was my own personal link. With Patreon, the RSS feed, each link is personal to your account. So if you happen to copy that one from my post, you're going to want to change it. If you haven't subscribed to the MacCast Patreon audio feed, and again, this is just for Patreon supporters, what you can do is you can log into the Patreon website, go to the MacCast Patreon page, and on the right-hand side, I think up near the top, you should see the personalized RSS audio link, and you can copy that link and put it into your favorite podcast app and be able to subscribe to it. Right now, there is just my one kind of intro post. I give you a little update on what's happening with some of your membership rewards and stuff like that. You can go listen to it. There is also an audio post if you just prefer to listen to it right inside Patreon. You can do that. You don't have to subscribe to the RSS. And I don't know at this point how frequently I'm going to be putting out new audio episodes just for Patreon supporters. I plan to do it from time to time, but there is not really going to be any set schedule. So if you want to add that to your feed, stuff will show up. I just don't know how frequently at this point, and I'm open to your suggestions. If it's something that you really enjoy and want me to do more of, I can try and do more of that. Again, time is always the issue, and you know, it's another reason why I'm doing the Patreon. If we can get a little bit more support, a little more revenue coming in, I'm hoping to have the ability to maybe bring on an intern or bring on some additional help. Maybe I can offload some of the things that I need to do on a daily basis to some other people, maybe some of the audio editing, some of the day-to-day sort of management of things. It's just right now, the way it works is it's all me. I do the hosting, I do the business management, I do, you know, all of the technical stuff. So at the end of the day, you just tend to run out of time, and time is really the limiting factor. So if you'd like to support the MacCast directly, I really, really appreciate it. My family appreciates it. You can get more information on the Patreon by checking out patreon.com/MacCast. You can read about the different reward levels and the different sponsorship levels. And really, any amount that you give is going directly into the MacCast and supporting the show and supporting what I do in bringing you these episodes. So thanks to everybody who already supports. I really, really appreciate it. Speaking of support, I do want to take a quick moment and thank my show sponsor, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all of their great applications and save 20% on Text Expander by going to textexpander.com/podcast. You can check out their apps at smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. As always, if you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send your emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And finally, if you'd like to follow me online between shows, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast, or check out the MacCast Google Plus community. That's at google.com/plusMacCast. That's going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.